It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, public radio host Rick Steves tells us how to travel better and smarter.
First, the federal trial over Wisconsin's voter laws came to a close yesterday. Nearly 15 laws are being disputed here. The most prominent, the state's voter photo ID law.
The lead plaintiff, One Wisconsin, said the laws unfairly targeted minorities, young people, and older residents in the state. And joining us to talk about the trial is Sean Johnson. He's the Capitol Bureau Chief for Wisconsin Public Radio. Sean, welcome back.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So, Sean, specifically, what issues did One Wisconsin have with the state's new voter ID laws?
So it's not just, unlike other challenges, this is not just the voter ID law. It's pretty much, you name it, any election law change that Republicans have made since they took over state government in 2011, this lawsuit basically folds those in and says that they're part of an ongoing effort by Republicans to intentionally make it harder for minorities, young people, and Democrats to vote. And so while they may not get everything they want, what they're essentially asking the federal court here is to throw all these laws out and, basically make the legislature come back and address these issues.
So one part of that parcel that you're talking about is the voter ID law. What else?
The voter ID law is, I think, is definitely the biggest. And then you've got changes to absentee voting. So you've got reductions in in-person absentee voting. I mean, they used to be able to, in Madison, Milwaukee, they would keep in-person absentee voting going on the weekends ahead of the election. They'd be going well into the evening in the run-up to the election. That was eliminated. You've got the end of straight ticket voting, which was eliminated. Just a bunch of stuff. And then the crown jewel of all that, the voter ID law, is challenged in this lawsuit.
And I understand the judge's remarks made the news. How do you read what the judge had to say?
So it's always dangerous to read into what a judge is saying in arguments like these because, I mean, Judge James Peterson's job is to basically sound skeptical in these arguments, right? I mean, he's there to he wanted to hold these arguments. He said he wanted to ask questions of both sides. And so that's what he did is he kind of tried to poke holes in arguments from both sides. But at least my read and some others who were there was that he sounded skeptical that he had the power or the need to overturn the entire voter ID law. I mean, one of his quotes was that he didn't dispute the idea that voter ID had made it much more difficult for some people to vote. But he said that the numbers of people weren't there to show that it had created a partisan advantage for Republicans in elections. Now, one of his quotes was, the difficulties were acute, but they were not widespread. And then he went on to say, an awful lot of people got IDs after the law was passed. Most people got their IDs. And he also said that there's no easy template for him to follow if he wanted to strike this down in the name of it being too partisan, because there's just not a case law like that he could follow.
Right. It sounds as though when he would turn to legal precedent, there isn't much to draw on.
Well, I mean, the precedent is that these laws have been upheld. So the Supreme Court has already upheld a voter ID law for Indiana. The Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals, which covers Illinois, Indiana, and Wisconsin, upheld Wisconsin's voter ID law. The plaintiffs who are challenging this law say, look, they did that before a lot of this had been implemented. And, the court there kind of had a rosy picture of how these alternative forms of ID were going to work. They haven't worked well. And so we still think you should overturn this law, especially when you look at the motivations behind passing it. But Judge Peterson, again, in his remarks from the bench, at least sounded like he was reluctant to take that step.
We're talking to Sean Johnson right now, Capitol Bureau Chief for Wisconsin Public Radio, and he's joining us to talk about the recent federal trial just ended over Wisconsin's voting laws. Arguments wrapped up yesterday. And Sean, we talked a bit about what the plaintiffs had to say. What about the defendants? What was their argument?
The defense argument is pretty simple. Basically, they told the judge, look at those two cases where laws like these have been upheld. The one that the U.S. Supreme Court decided, which upheld voter ID laws in general, and then the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals decision that upheld Wisconsin's law in particular. And then they said the other problem with the case by plaintiffs is that it relies too much on anecdotes. I mean, a big part of closing arguments for plaintiffs, one Wisconsin Institute's lawyers, was testimony of Todd Albaugh. Todd Albaugh is a former Republican staffer for former Republican state senator Dale Schultz. And Albaugh testified that he was in the room in the Republican caucus when they discussed voter ID privately. And he said that some Republican senators were giddy at the prospect. He talked about some Republicans saying, you know, we have to think about what this law would do for neighborhoods around Milwaukee, for college campuses, college towns. And attorneys for One Wisconsin Institute said basically, when you start talking about how it's going to affect neighborhoods in Milwaukee, that's code and not even, you know, thinly veiled code, code for how it's going to suppress black votes. And they so they said, you know, that is enough right there for you, judge, to overturn this law because it had a racist intent. Attorneys for the state said basically this is that you're going on. An anecdote here from a guy who was in the room who said that a guy said something and that's not enough to overturn a law. Again, look at what courts have already decided in these cases.
So in closing, what were the arguments from both sides?
The arguments from One Wisconsin Institute are that you have to look at this as not just the voter ID law, which, you know, by itself has been upheld in other courts, but you have to look at the pattern of all these laws and that the pattern was they didn't make it easier to vote in any cases, that Wisconsin already had a good system for voting. It was highly regarded nationally and that the laws cumulatively have made it harder and harder to vote in Wisconsin and specifically for people who live in cities and more often minorities and young people to vote. And they said, you know, judge, that's what you need to know, that there was an intent when they passed these laws to make it harder for certain groups of people, and that's unconstitutional. You know, the state says that's a little more creative than you need to get. Keep it simple. Look at these cases and realize they don't have an actual plaintiff in these cases that's challenging all these provisions. So you really can't take this step.
So, Sean, it sounds as though when the decision comes down, well, the judge has said he might end up disappointing both sides here. So does that mean he could end up upholding some and overturning others? What are you expecting?
Yeah, because there's so many laws that are challenged here, it's really tough to predict exactly what he might do. I mean, one of the options that he could do with voter ID, for example, there was this talk that he could make it easier for somebody who doesn't have the documents they need to get an ID to, instead of going to the Department of Motor Vehicles and, you know, swearing that they are who they say they are, getting an affidavit and then going to vote, maybe the judge could say, you just go do that at the polling place, which would, you know, make it a lot easier for people to vote in these instances. I'm not saying that's what he'd do. It's a possibility that was discussed in court. And then you go on down the line to more than a dozen other changes. If he found some of those there was no solid reason for them and there was a partisan intent behind them, or they did silence the votes of minorities intentionally, perhaps he could pick those out one by one. But we don't really know what he's going to do. He was pretty clear when the trial portion of this case wrapped up that what he decided was going to disappoint both sides. We don't know what that means.
And Sean, last couple of seconds, but ruling is expected when?
He said that he wanted to have this decision by the end of July. And so that wouldn't be in enough time to have it take effect for the August 9th primary. But it would be handed down in enough time, he thought, to give both sides a chance, or, you know, whoever wants to appeal, a chance to appeal it to the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals ahead of the November election. And in a case like this, you can, you know, be guaranteed that there would be an appeal.
Sean, thanks a lot for joining us.
You're welcome.
That was Sean Johnson, Capital Bureau Chief for Wisconsin Public Radio, and he joined us to talk about the federal trial over Wisconsin voting laws that wrapped up arguments yesterday.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, a self-proclaimed vegetable butcher shares no-fuss tips for slicing, dicing, and masterfully cooking vegetable main courses.
First, summer is peak season for European travel. Our next guest has been making it his calling to help travelers get the most out of their travels to Europe and beyond.
Rick Steves hosts the public TV series Rick Steves Europe, and his public radio show Travel with Rick Steves joins WPR's weekend lineup tomorrow. You can catch it on Saturdays at 3 o'clock. Rick, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks, Veronica. Good to be with you.
Well, Rick, you encourage people who travel to become what you call temporary locals. Can you explain what you mean by that?
Well, the challenge for us is to make sure we get the most experience out of every mile, minute, and dollar we have in our trip. And when we go like tourists, a lot of times we see just tired old cliches on stage and we fall into the arms of people that just see us as a chance to make money. And that's part of tourism, you know. But I like to distinguish my trip by becoming a temporary local and basically doing things locals do for fun. I like to think of myself as a cultural chameleon. If I'm in Czech Republic, I'll drink a nice lager. If I'm in Belgium, I'll drink a nice dark monk-made beer. If I'm in England, I'll have a spot of tea. I never drink a spot of tea in the United States. It just seems kind of strange. But when I'm in England, it seems right. So you want to get yourself in a mindset of eating with the season, going with the locals. Don't compare things to back home, but just embrace things the way they are over there and celebrate it.
And along that same line of thinking, you also say that meaningful contact with local people is a must for travelers. What is the best way to do that and maybe not have it feel forced?
Yeah, the problem is it's a huge industry. I mean, the number one employer in Europe by some measures is tourism. And, you know, when you get off your tour bus in front of the Vatican, there's a guy sitting on the curb that's just going to jump up and try to sell you things. And when you go to the hotel and you ask him where should you go to eat, they're going to send you off to the touristy restaurant that has the folkloric dancers or whatever. And, again, that's part of it. But you need to find a way in each country to connect with locals. I mean, when I'm in Finland, there's nothing better than to go into a working-class neighborhood and find a neighborhood sauna. I mean, these days, you know, you have to be up to date on the information. Finland is so affluent these days that neighborhood saunas are getting kind of rare because most people are wealthy enough to have a sauna at home. Mm. And many workplaces just provide a sauna also. But if you go out to the neighborhoods where the working class is, you'll find the whole gang gathered at the sauna. And to sit naked in a sauna with a bunch of Finns, you sit there, it's a woody world with steam and pasty blonde hair on sweaty faces. And you don't know what century you're in, but you do know you're in Finland. You can't help but be immersed in the culture when you do something like that. When you go to Istanbul, go to a little taverna and suck on a hookah and play backgammon. I mean, you should know how to play backgammon before you go to Turkey. When you go to France, go to the park and play boules with the old guys. I mean, under a tree in every park in France, it seems there's retired guys playing boules, lawn bowling. And I just love that. And it's an opportunity there for the taking. But good travelers know how to connect, and other travelers stay at hotel in their hotel and watch a movie in their hotel room. You need to get out. When you go to a pub in England, you can sit at a table, but when you sit at the bar, that's a signal that you want to talk. And the pub is a public house. That's where the word pub comes from. And if you want to connect with locals anywhere in Britain or Ireland, sit at the bar in a pub, and you'll have all the friends in the world.
But the kinds of stuff you're talking about, I mean, a lot of them are not the kinds of things you'll find in a guidebook, are they?
Well, you know, most travel writers try to get off the beaten path in this sort of thing, but there's a system that tries to direct us. When I land in Europe with my public television TV crew, it's like we're met at the airport with a lady in a dirndl that wants to take us out to the new casino. They've got all this stuff that was invested in for their industry in the last year, and they see us as a chance to push business their way. And my goal as a travel teacher is to help my American travelers better understand whatever country they're going to. And this is so important these days because, the United States is 4% of this planet, and I think it's more important than ever that we play ball with the other 96%. And it's just so fun to get out of your comfort zone and realize that smart people find different truths to be self-evident and God-given. And, you know, we don't need to go home and look forward to a cheese course every night. But when I'm in France, that cheese course is sort of the highlight of my day.
How are Americans perceived abroad these days? I know you specialize in Europe, but there are heightened tensions about various sorts, political and otherwise. What do you need to know about being an American while traveling abroad right now?
Well, you know, there's a lot of concern about that within our country these days because there's a lot of edginess in the political discourse in our country, and there's also a lot of fear-mongering, I think, within our society, and we tend to the consequence of that is we get a frightened citizenry. I remember in the old days people said bon voyage. Now people don't say bon voyage. They say have a safe trip. And, you know, I just think that's a very troubling sort of notion. I think if people knew what was going on, they'd realize you're much safer if you leave this country than if you stay here, statistically. Anytime somebody tells me to have a safe trip, I want to say, well, you have a safe stay at home. Because if you really cared for your loved ones, you know what the statistics were, you'd take them to Europe tomorrow. You know, it's safe over there. It's dangerous here. As far as our reception in Europe, I spend 4 months a year in Europe every year. I've done that for the last 30 years, 120 days of traveling. I'm meeting people all the time. I just got back from a two-month trip, a wonderful two-month trip, and Sunday I'm flying away for another two-month trip, and it doesn't even occur to me what do they think about Americans? You know, we're all in this together, and people are just people who live in different countries, and we have different styles, and we have different passions. We're tackling the same problems with a different sort of cultural context, and it is just really refreshing and fun and uplifting to travel around the world and realize it's. And there's a lot more good than bad, and the more we connect, the safer and happier we'll all be. But as far as Europe goes, we take 20,000 people to Europe every year on our tours, and I'm very in touch with how people are received around Europe because I'm in charge of making sure these people have a good time. It is not an issue. You go to Europe and you have a good time. You travel anywhere, and you know, you can meet people, and you can respect people. And when you come home, you're probably more thankful than ever that you're a citizen of our country. But you're a little, you can empathize better with people outside of our borders. And I think that's, you know, for me, the greatest souvenir that you could bring home is a global perspective, and that's something I treasure.
You're an experienced traveler, and you spent a lot of time, as you said, traveling abroad. I am curious, though, if that stereotype, and I hope it's a stereotype, of the boorish American traveler is still out there alive and well, or is it a more sophisticated world, and everybody knows that each person is unique and individual now?
Mm-hmm. You know, I think Americans have their naivete and their playfulness and their curiosity and their ethnocentrism, and in some ways the American eagle is not house-trained. I think Europeans, you know, my beat is Europe, so I travel mostly in Europe, but I travel all over the world, and I find that people enjoy meeting us as individuals. And there's plenty to talk about politically if you want to talk politics. I find in Europe anyways, people are a little polite about jumping right into a political discussion. Let's say you are of a political persuasion that you think might not be popular in Europe. Nobody's going to make you talk politics. You know, if you support ideas that would be the opposite of what Europeans support, you could see that as a great opportunity to talk with smart people and get a different perspective, even though you don't need to change your mind. Or you could say, let's just talk about, you know, wine or soccer or the weather and have an equally fun trip. So I find Europeans are respectful that way. If you do broach politics or religion or these kind of things, Europeans love to talk, and they're very smart. And I find that's one of the great joys of travel, is having Europeans put me in my place to rough up my ethnocentrism. As experienced of a traveler as I may be, and as much as I pride myself in being open to other cultures and other ways of thinking, I'm ethnocentric to a certain degree, just like any American. We're proud of our country. We have a great country, and we're inclined to think we do it right. But we don't do it right. We do it our way, and we may like our way, but Europeans choose to do it a different way. And the last thing I'm ever going to do is judge Europeans for, you know, not having capital punishment, or judge Europeans for giving people paid vacations, or judge Europeans for taking care of their environment. You know, I'm not going to put them down for that. I'll just say, oh, you guys see things differently than we do. And I think that's a stimulating and a challenging part of travel that for me makes the plane ticket one of the best values in the world.
We're talking with Rick Steves right now. He's the host of Travel with Rick Steves. And one thing you've been writing about lately, Rick, is the allure of leaving the hotel at night and taking part in the nightlife of a city.
Oh,
what have you been seeing and doing?
Well, it was interesting because I was just in Europe, and it occurred to me I was in Europe for 2 months. I just got back. I was all over. I had a great trip from Lisbon and Spain and Catalonia and the Alps and the greatest of Italy. I was in Bulgaria. I was in Romania. A fascinating time in Romania. And when I flew home, on the last night in the hotel, it occurred to me, I have not turned on the TV for 60 nights in a row in hotels. The TV is there. It's always there. And the first thing I do when I get into a room is put the remote away, because I'm so immersed in that culture, I don't really want to turn on the TV. And what I like to do at night, during the day I'm working. I'm working on my guidebooks, or I'm working on my tours, or I'm working on my TV shows. But at night, when I want to take a break, I put all of the work away, and I just go out and walk around. And, you know, when you're in the middle of the day in Florence, it is a zoo with tourists, and there's long lines, and there's hustlers, and there's just intensity, and there's harsh light with the sun. You go back out at night, and you walk around the same great squares, and it is like a time tunnel experience. You're just back in the Renaissance. It's you and floodlit facades and a few well-chosen street musicians and some sparkling bars where cool people are sitting out and enjoying their spritz. And I just think, whoa, I could have missed this. I could have been sitting in the hotel room. But no, I'm just going to take a slow stroll through the magnificent squares of Florence or Oslo or Dublin or Lisbon or whatever after dark.
Rick, thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, and I am so excited to be able to share my passion for travel. It's, you know, as a travel writer, I focus mostly on Europe. But the fun thing for me with our radio show is we get to talk to people from all corners, domestic travel here in the United States, travel in the developing world, and, of course, traveling in Europe. And I'm just thankful to have a chance to be part of your family at Wisconsin Public Radio, and look forward to more travels together.
We're looking forward to it. Thank you. Mm-hmm. That was travel expert Rick Steves. He's the host of the public radio show Travel with Rick Steves. You can catch it Saturday afternoons at 3 on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up after the news, we hear from a self-proclaimed vegetable butcher, and we'll find out how to select, prep, slice, dice, and masterfully cook vegetables from artichokes to zucchini. I'm Rob Ferrett.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferrett.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, we talk state tax credits, vaping regulations, and more on our Wisconsin News Roundup.
First, the phrase vegetable butcher may sound like a contradiction, but it's a job description Chef Kara Mangini proudly embraces.
The Columbus, Ohio-based restaurateur comes from a long line of butchers, but she likes to wield her own knife, not on tenderloins and chicken breasts, but on Brussels sprouts and butternut squashes.
In her new book, Mangini gives vegetables center stage, sharing practical tips and cutting techniques to make them, quote, as modern, sexy, and extraordinarily delicious as they ought to be.
Kara Mangini joins us now. She's a chef, restaurateur, and author of the book, The Vegetable Butcher, How to Select, Prep, Slice, Dice, and Masterfully Cook Vegetables from Artichokes to Zucchini. Kara, welcome to Central Time.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
Well, it sounds like you come from a long line of meat butchers. So how did you decide to break tradition and become a vegetable butcher?
Well, I think I realized there was a real need for vegetable education, and I spent a lot of time traveling and cooking and seeing that in other cultures, ultimately, that vegetables were a little more second nature and intuitive, and people just had a sense of cooking with them, not as an afterthought or as a side dish, but it was a little more the center of the plate, and realized that's where my interest was and broke away and decided to focus on vegetables.
And what do we get from adopting that mentality of approaching vegetables, but with that sort of butcher mindset to preparing them?
Well, I think sometimes preparing vegetables can feel a little bit intimidating. And I think that having the understanding of knife skills, you know, how to handle each vegetable that we pick up or that we see at a farmer's market, helps make cooking a whole lot easier. And, you know, so I think that education really helps when we get in the kitchen and also gets us more excited about cooking with vegetables and eating them every day.
Well, I read that you were traveling through Europe when you were out of college, and that's when you realized that vegetables were kind of where it was at for you. There were all these different things you were trying. What was that time of your life like?
It was pretty incredible, and certainly a lot of things came into focus at that time. I realized ultimately that, vegetables just were a part of the plate in a really natural, intuitive way. And it was exciting to see the kinds of dishes that, featured vegetables. And, you know, it wasn't about, vegetable being on the side or, a small part of the plate. And, you know, it really inspired me to focus on vegetables. And also, I think during that time, I really recognized the connection between food and health. And that as a culture, and for myself also, you know, if I wanted to be as healthy as possible, that I needed to know how to cook with vegetables and do it every day, not just as, you know, for a special occasion or, again, as a side dish. So it was an exciting time to really be inspired by the kinds of dishes and recipes that you see in France and Italy and Turkey and Spain. Certainly that set the stage for a career ultimately very focused on vegetables.
Before we get to some specific tips and recipes, Kara, I wonder if you could give maybe a pep talk. Some people are on board with you, of course, already, but some people think of eat your veggies as, you know, a chore, and they envision mushy boiled broccoli or something like that. Can you get those people excited about becoming a vegetable butcher and trying exciting new ways to try veggies?
Totally. Well, first I would say you're not alone, because I had that same experience, and I think a lot of us have. It starts with a bad childhood experience of, you know, some oversteamed or boiled vegetable or canned vegetable that, you know, that doesn't have the flavor that ultimately fresh vegetables picked in their prime and prepared the right way do. So, number one, you're not alone. But, you know, there are some really simple techniques that can really help make vegetables really wonderful and delicious and ultimately very satisfying. And vegetables don't have to mean sacrifice. So, you know, ultimately I think that eating vegetables means eating, you know, if you can within the season. When vegetables are in their prime, they have incredible flavor. You don't have to do much to them. Nature ultimately provides that flavor. And so, it doesn't take the kind of work that you might imagine. But having some of these knife skills and also just some of the tips and techniques and tricks that I share in the book will really help you along the way and make it not only just the process of cooking with vegetables, challenging, but really ultimately, I think, inspire you to cook and eat with them. And know that there's incredibly rich and wonderful, exciting flavor that comes with every season that you don't find in other ingredients.
Well, I'm a mostly vegetarian, and I can attest that trying to cook vegetables with a dull knife or the wrong knife is a special kind of torture. So what kind of knife do you suggest for working with all these vegetables and chopping them up?
I think ultimately it just, you know, you've said it, it takes a sharp knife. And the one that I recommend, I think it's important to have an 8-inch chef's knife. So, you know, I think the knife companies, sometimes you get that big butcher block of knives. You don't need all of those knives. Ultimately, there's a handful that I think are really helpful. But the number one knife that you need is an 8-inch chef's knife. A 10-inch knife is great, too, if you're comfortable. It's a little bit harder to manage, so if you're comfortable with it, that's great. But you want to keep it sharp, and that means ultimately honing your knife and sending them out to get sharpened. But, you know, ultimately you want to pick one that feels comfortable in your hand so that, you know, you set yourself up for success and that, you know, it's a comfortable process, not something that you dread doing. And the other piece to that I would say is also important to have a good board because that works with your knife. And if you have either a very small and cramped board or a surface that is, doesn't work well with your knife, the whole process, I think, is going to be challenging and awkward and you're going to dread getting in the kitchen and chopping up your vegetables. So I recommend a large wood board if you can. You can use a plastic board if you would like, but the wood is going to keep your knife sharper longer, and it's a joy to work on.
We're cooking vegetables with Kara Mangini. Her new book is called The Vegetable Butcher. Well, let's start naming names here, Kara. My zucchini plants at home have tiny zucchini. They're getting bigger a little bit every day. We get a lot of zucchini here in Wisconsin. Give us a creative way to freshen up our zucchini repertoire.
Okay, so there are a bunch of things. I love zucchini because you really can keep it in your vegetable drawer and have a meal really all summer long. So the first thing I would say is I love just a really simple dish of pan-roasted zucchini. You can just cook it up with a little bit of garlic and olive oil. You want to dice your zucchini, and then olive oil, garlic, zucchini, a little bit of red pepper flake, maybe a little bit of cumin, and then you finish it with fresh mint and basil, and then put a big spoonful of ricotta on top. That's one of my favorite things to do. You could also toss that same combination with pasta and sweet corn. And caramelized onions. It would be delicious. You could swap in mozzarella instead of the ricotta, but it's nice to put a big scoop of ricotta on top of your pasta also. Those are my favorites. The other thing that you can do is enjoy zucchini raw. And whether you use a manual vegetable peeler to peel big, wide ribbons, or there's also a peeler that has a julienne blade that will basically peel your zucchini into very thin little ribbons, and you can toss that raw zucchini with lemon and olive oil, a mix of summer herbs, pine nuts, and Parmesan cheese, and it makes a beautiful salad, and, of course, finish with a little bit of lemon juice and lemon zest.
And you've shared with us a couple of recipes, one for eggplant, tomato, and mozzarella stacks with some pesto sauce and a balsamic reduction. And this is what I just discovered sort of later in life that I love eggplant. So how does the eggplant come together in this with all those other flavors?
Well, I love, you know, there are a lot of people who don't love eggplant, and I think it's because there is a bitterness that comes with eggplant when it ages. But if you buy eggplant in season, and ultimately it has a really wonderful sweet and nutty flavor. And so in this particular recipe, I love that it's sort of a fresh take on a caprese salad, the classic tomato and mozzarella and basil pairing. But when you add eggplant, it adds this wonderful meatiness to that classic salad, and really it becomes a main dish that you can serve a couple stacks, and that's all you need, maybe with a little arugula salad on the side. But that eggplant adds not only when you grill it this wonderful smokiness, but the texture adds this wonderful richness and texture and meatiness to the dish. I love that one with the pesto, fresh pesto, and the balsamic reduction adds just this wonderful sweetness. And I love that dish also. It's a great one to bring to any summer gathering or barbecue. It travels really well, and it shows off also wonderful heirloom tomatoes that come out this time of year also.
We've got that recipe along with another one, actually, at WPR.org. Look for the Central Time page there and find the recipes. Another one you shared, and we've got a video for this one, by the way, linked on the Central Time Facebook page, grilled asparagus. Still some asparagus out there, I think. Taleggio, I don't know what that is, and fried egg panini. Talk us through that one.
Oh, I love that. I'm glad you mentioned that. So this is a wonderful sandwich that I think, you know, asparagus is one that you really look forward to all year, and I think that this recipe really celebrates that moment of the year when asparagus is out. Taleggio is this wonderful Italian cheese that adds just incredible richness. But it's basically it's a panini. It's a sandwich that is layered with grilled asparagus, the Taleggio, arugula that's been dressed in lemon. It is really amazing, and then also a fried egg, and it's just, you know, it's kind of my answer to those vegetable-based or vegetarian sandwiches that just have this sort of measly, mealy tomato and lettuce and a piece of cheese. This is this really wonderful, bright, and delicious, and hearty vegetable-inspired sandwich.
We're talking about putting veggies front and center on the dinner table, and we want to hear from you on this. Have you recently switched to maybe making vegetables more of a main meal, maybe eating more of them? What worked with your family and what didn't? Are there any vegetables that you're kind of confused by? You can't figure out exactly how to cut them, how to prepare them, what the best way is, something maybe for the 4th of July. Well, you can let us know. What has you stumped from the farmer's market? 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. 1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Kara Mangini stays with us. She's the author of The Vegetable Butcher, How to Select, Prep, Slice, Dice, and Masterfully Cook Vegetables from Artichokes to Zucchini. More coming up on Food Friday here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. And right now we're continuing our conversation about how to prepare vegetables just right for delicious meals. Kara Mangini is with us. She's the author of The Vegetable Butcher, How to Select, Prep, Slice, Dice, and Masterfully Cook Vegetables from Artichokes to Zucchini.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. What's your favorite way to cook and or eat a particular vegetable? What are you getting a lot of in your garden, your farmer's market, your CSA this time of year? Need some help using it all up? Need some clues on what to do with that mystery vegetable? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go to our callers now. Eric is on the line in Beloit. Eric, hi.
Hello. I have a way for zucchinis. My Italian neighbors used to cook fried zucchini flowers, not the fruit, but the flowers. They would be breaded and deep fried, and I don't know if there's any other flowers, but that certainly is one way to use the zucchini before they become zucchini.
Eric, thanks a lot for that. I think you talk about cooking with the zucchini flowers in your book, Kara.
Yes, there's a wonderful recipe for pan-fried zucchini blossoms. They're stuffed with lemon, goat cheese, basil, and mint. And yes, absolutely, that's a wonderful way to use the squash blossoms and really, you're essentially using something that maybe some people might toss aside, but they're delicious. They're also beautiful to tear and put into a salad or maybe top a crostini with as well, with a little olive oil and sea salt.
Kara, I've tried to cook zucchini blossoms before, much the same way you just described, stuffed with the cheese, and then they were actually fried. But everything in the middle kind of came out and smushed around. What's your secret for keeping it together?
So the important thing is you can use a paring knife. And it's important to use them right away. They are very perishable. So if you do have an opportunity to get your hands on them, you want to use them right away. And then you just use a paring knife, and you want to cut down the side of the flower and make sure not to cut all the way through it. So you just make a small little slit and then stuff them. And then you want to twist the top of the flower to keep all the stuffing in. So you kind of have to wrap that stuffing back up, but twisting the top really helps to keep everything inside.
Eric, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. We go next to Peter in Beaver Dam. Peter, hi.
Hi, how's it going? I have 12 kohlrabi plants, and I have no idea what to do with them.
Did you plant them on purpose?
Well, it was an accident because I sent my wife to the greenhouse, and she came back with 12 kohlrabi plants.
All right. So a bumper crop of kohlrabi on the way, Kara. What can you do with all of it?
So, again, you are not alone there. A lot of people, I think, struggle with what in the world do I do with kohlrabi, and it's something that comes in a lot of the farm boxes if you've signed up for a CSA. Kohlrabi is so delicious and wonderful, and there are tons of things you can do. So one of my favorite things is to do a fried rice. So you briefly just steam the kohlrabi and then toss it with day-old rice and red pepper flakes, garlic. You can also use the greens on the kohlrabi. So if you tear them away from their stems, slice them really thin, you can steam toss the greens right into the stir fry, into the rice, and then of course crack an egg and top it with cashews or sesame seeds. It's wonderful with a little lime juice or some sesame oil, but a fried rice is great, and there's a recipe in the book for it. I think it's also just delicious simply roasted. It becomes very sweet at a high temperature and after it's been in the oven for a while. Kohlrabi is also really delicious raw, and you can throw it into any of your summer slaw recipes. And basically you can slice it very thin into thin strips, matchsticks. You can also slice it into thin rounds. There's a recipe in the book for a carpaccio, basically very thin slices of kohlrabi with a lemon balsamic vinaigrette, pears, and pistachios. It basically makes a wonderful salad. And And then, of course, there's also a, in the book I do a strata, so a bread pudding, essentially, with kohlrabi and cheddar. But kohlrabi is wonderful. You can really swap it in for any, when you want sort of a cabbage flavor, even that kind of broccoli flavor, throw it into any stir fry. It's really, really a wonderful vegetable, and I think one that a lot of us not only don't really know how to work with, but are lacking some good inspiring recipes that would get us excited about it. So those are some ideas.
Peter, thanks a lot for the call. And we go next to John joining us in Green Bay. Hi, John.
Hi there. I'm going to say a question, if your guests could comment. Has there been kind of an evolution in vegetable preparation? I guess what I mean is...
Has there been an evolution in vegetable preparation? I'm not sure what he was pointing to, but
our producer says he was interested in the rise of roasting vegetables. Actually,
roasting,
are you seeing
okay.
more and more of that, Kara?
I do. You know, I think what's great about roasting and why we're seeing a trend toward it is it's a really easy way to cook vegetables. Not only just kind of mindless cooking where you can, you know, cut up your vegetables, throw it in the oven, and it's not that active cooking time. But roasting adds wonderful, rich flavor to vegetables. So it allows you to get some color on them, some good texture. You know, you leave it in there until you get that sort of nice golden brown color and a little bit of crispness. And I think it just adds wonderful flavor, and I think we're all really responding to that rather than, over steaming or boiling vegetables that maybe was the trend or maybe just kind of the go-to, years and years ago. But it's also just really simple cooking, and which I think with vegetables is really the best way. You know, they come to us with this wonderful, unique flavor, and roasting really draws that out.
Well, thanks a lot for that question, Eric. Hope that helps. And we're going to go to Julie. Julie joins us next in Toma. Hi, Julie.
I would like to freeze sweet corn, but I have had multiple people tell me that just doesn't freeze well and turn out well. Do you have any recommendations for how to potentially freeze sweet corn?
Good questions. Freezing sweet corn, can you do it?
Yeah, I love to freeze sweet corn. So, you know, if you buy it, you know, as it's in its prime, and you want to freeze it as soon as possible, it's best to take it right off of the cob right when you get it home. So a special trick there is if you break the cob in half with two hands and then shave the kernels off the cob, when you have the corn split, the kernels won't fly all over your kitchen if you use a whole cob. So break it in half first, then shave all around the cob, and then you can freeze it just like that, and add it to whatever you're adding it to. You can blanch it briefly in boiling water just for seconds when you go to use it, or you can add it to whatever kind of dishes you want throughout the year.
Julie, thanks a lot for that call. Kara, I'm wondering, you're based in Ohio, mm-hmm. Pretty similar climate to most of Wisconsin. So what's coming into season now that's got you really excited to get cooking with it?
Well, zucchini, of course, is the thing that's just come onto the scene. So in the restaurant, we've just added zucchini all over the menu. We're doing a frittata and a wonderful quinoa salad with Parmesan vinaigrette and almonds. I love the cabbages that are coming out right now. The beets are looking beautiful. Tomatoes are just coming out. We're starting to see the cherry tomatoes. And, of course, they're just so sweet and delicious and full of flavor. And heirlooms, of course, will be not too far behind. The eggplants are starting to come. They're still a little bit small, but eggplants, especially when they're small, they have very few seeds, and they're even more sweet and nutty than when they mature and get a little bit bigger. So if you can get your hands on the eggplant, definitely you can do that now also. This is just such an exciting time that things start to pop up. And I think, you know, when you live in a climate where there's, you know, you go through rough winters, it's pretty exciting to anticipate these moments where things just start coming out and bring us all those flavors that we miss in the wintertime.
Kara, thanks a lot. It's been fun and inspirational.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me. Happy cooking to everyone.
That's Kara Mangini. Her new book is called The Vegetable Butcher, How to Select, prep, slice, dice, and masterfully cook vegetables from artichokes to zucchini. I've got a video linked on the Central Time Facebook page. That one is grilled asparagus, taleggio, and fried egg panini, and a couple print versions of the recipes at WPR.org. Find us Central Time. And by the way, while you're over at the Central Time Facebook page, let us know your favorite vegetable to cook with and your favorite recipe to cook with it. This is Central Time. Wisconsin may be experiencing a wave of cheese theft, and we're not talking about shoplifting here and there. It's disappearing by the truckload.
On Thursday, in fact, in Oak Creek, someone drove off with a delivery truck holding an estimated 20,000 pounds of assorted cheeses.
That's this week. There were two incidents earlier this year, back in January. Thefts in Marshfield and Germantown. Thieves there made off with over $160,000 in cheese. The cheese was recovered in those cases. I couldn't find anything online about arrests being made. So the suspects, I guess, still at large in this cheese rustling?
The cheese thieves. The cheese rustlers are still at large. And this is serious. It's a good stuff. Cheese is being stolen here in Wisconsin.
We couldn't figure out what kind of cheese. A taleggio?
A while back, it was Parmesan. Okay, we knew that much. I don't know about taleggio. Could be.
So be on the lookout. I believe this is an unmarked white truck that they're looking for. So it may be hard to spot out there. Hopefully the cheese pipeline in Wisconsin will not be interrupted by the theft of these truckloads of cheese.
In the meantime, we got to figure out where'd the cheese go.
This is Central Time. I don't know.